All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today is another Q&A episode. We'll be spending quite a bit of time talking about the Falcons trading up, various contract situations, and we'll also be talking about their most recent addition of offensive tackle, John Wetzel.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
So guys, you know me, I'm Aaron Freeman, been covering the Falcons for many years at FalcFans.com, on Twitter at FalcFans, and of course, the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. Today is a Q&A episode. You guys have sent in a lot of great questions over the last week, and really the last 10 days since I did my last Q&A, which was, I think, April 8th, two Mondays ago. And I want to get to some of those. I don't know if I'll be getting to all of those questions, but as I have previously mentioned and haven't really done since like February, whatever questions I don't get to on today's episode, I will try to put up a leftover mailbag on FalcFans.com this weekend. So where can you send in your mailbag questions for those of you that are tuning into the show for the first time or for the second time or whenever, and you want to ask your own questions and get some of your other issues and things and provide other feedback to me? You can do so, of course, on Twitter at Locked On Falcons. You can send it via Facebook at Locked On Falcons is the name of the page there. Give us a like while you're there. You can also send an email address if you don't like social media. The email address is lockedonfalcons@mail.com, or you can leave a comment at falcfans.com where the podcast is posted daily. So before we jump into the questions, I do want to talk a little bit about the Falcons' recent addition of John Wetzel, who they officially announced that they had signed on Tuesday. Presumably he was one of the players that they worked out on Monday alongside Chris Odom and several other players this past Monday, and apparently he did a good enough job to be offered a contract, which I don't know the exact terms of, but I'm guessing is a veteran minimum type of deal. Basically, Wetzel is I use the term capable loosely, backup. I don't want to slander John Wetzel too much on this, but he has been a player that has played a lot over the last couple of seasons for the Arizona Cardinals, in large part due to them having a lot of injuries across the roster. What Wetzel has, sort of been able to accomplish, the good thing you can say is he's versatile because he's either logged starts or gotten playing time in that 3-year span at 4 out of the 5 offensive line positions: left tackle, left guard, and right tackle. And, he's a player that has some versatility that can be a sort of a plug-and-play sort of injury replacement. But, part of the reason why the Arizona offensive line has not been particularly good in recent seasons is not to sort of pin that on John Wetzel, but because they've had to rely on Wetzel and players like him rather than quality starters these last couple of years. He's not necessarily a guy that you want starting for you for extended period of times, but for a game or two, and having that sort of versatility, he's valuable in that sense. What is Wetzel bringing to the table? I don't expect him to be, a contender to challenge Ty Sambrello for a starting spot. If anything, he's going to, push Matt Gano as a swing tackle. But again, as you guys who are regularly listening to this podcast over the last several months, know that I expect the Falcons to prioritize drafting an offensive tackle early in this draft, who I think will probably, be the guy that will challenge Ty Sambrello for that starting spot. And the loser of that battle will wind up being probably the team's swing tackle, which leaves Wetzel and Gano potentially fighting for one roster spot. And one would assume that if Gano shows the same sort of potential and upside that he showed last summer at various times, then he would probably be kept over a guy like Wetzel. Wetzel's essentially, calling him a camp body is not necessarily fair, but he's basically a guy I think the Falcons are bringing in to sort of bolster their competition in training camp. And, potentially in some sort of worst case scenario where the Falcons aren't able to address their offensive tackle position in the first two rounds of the draft and have to settle, quote unquote, settle for a player in the third or fourth round that they're not necessarily enthusiastic about, then having an experienced veteran like Wetzel kind of softens the blow. The scenario I'm envisioning is Falcons wind up drafting an offensive tackle, say in round 3 or round 4, that they're not necessarily in love with. and that guy isn't necessarily ready to really push Ty Sambrelo and may or may not be ready to, really sort of win that swing tackle position, and having a guy like Wetzel softens the blow. He doesn't replace a sort of a first or second round pick is basically what I'm saying, but should the Falcons not land a quality offensive tackle in this draft, he somewhat softens the blow of that not necessarily going their way. So that's basically John Wetzel in a nutshell. We'll come back in a moment to answer your guys' questions, including, the first couple or dealing with trading up and down in this draft. But before we get there, I want to remind you guys that you guys got to check out the Locked On NFL podcast this week. Today is part 5 of the mock draft series that the Locked On Podcast Network is running this week, where a host of all the Locked On podcast shows pick for their respective teams. You also get additional analysis from Locked On NFL host Matt Williamson, from the Locked On NFL Draft hosts, from the Draft Dudes hosts, as well as some of the hosts from the college shows that we have on the Locked On Podcast Network. Definitely want to check it out. I think it's the best 5-part series. You want to listen to it in its entirety if you haven't been so far this week. Find the Locked On NFL podcast on whatever podcast platform you listen to your Locked On podcast shows, including the new Himalaya podcast app, your team every day. So our first question comes from Davon Wilson at DWizzy1997. It's a two-parter. He asks, one, how do you feel about drafting Rashawn Gary for his ability to play defensive line and edge over Montez Sweat or any other edge who couldn't? And two, is it feasible that the Falcons could stay put at 14 and draft a great pass rusher, then trade back in the first round and draft Ford Little or another offensive lineman? I think I'm not a huge Rashawn Gary guy. I think he's a talented player, but I think the idea that him playing inside, I think has been a little bit overrated, at least when I watch him, because I think while he has the potential there, it's going to have to be taught to him because he just really hasn't been played. And I think the real knock on Rashawn Gary is regardless of where you play him, you're basically going to have to teach him everything because he's just kind of is out there at Michigan just being a good athlete, which he is. He's a great athlete. But I think, being a pass rusher in the NFL is such a technical aspect. Playing defensive line is such a technical aspect. You put your hand here, you put your foot here. It's just not simply you can just go out there and just out-athlete guys unless you're like a Julius Peppers type of athlete. And I think this has been the problem that the Falcons have come up with Vic Beasley because he's not a Julius Peppers type of athlete. He's a great athlete. But, at 6'2", 235, 245 pounds, it's not the same as being 6'6", 285 pounds. You know what I'm saying? And while Rashawn Gary is closer on the closer to Julius Peppers on that spectrum, I don't think he's on that Julius Peppers or Jadeveon Clowney level as just a guy that can just purely dominate his competition by pure athleticism, or else he would have done that at Michigan because he was definitely facing much lesser athletes at Michigan than he'll face in the NFL. So all that being said, for me, at least looking at Rashawn Gary, I kind of like him more as a linebacker in a 3-4 scheme where he's playing, which is a far less technical position. This is kind of the same reasons why I like Vic Beasley is because he doesn't have necessarily those technical aspects of being a great pass rusher, knowing how to use his hands and all those sorts of things. Those things can be taught. We've seen that with a guy like Danielle Hunter in Minnesota, who was very raw coming out of LSU several years ago. But obviously the Falcons haven't necessarily done a great job doing that, teaching that with Vic Beasley over these last 4 years. And so for me, with a guy like Rashawn Gary playing more of a linebacker role where it's less technical of a position where you can kind of just go around, run around and be a good athlete and still be able to make plays, I think makes a lot more sense, at least in terms of, sort of projecting him to the NFL where you don't have to sort of basically teach him, how to be a defensive lineman. And you can just basically just go out there and be an athlete, dude. And I think that kind of makes more sense for him. So I wouldn't necessarily prefer Rashawn Gary because of that perceived versatility. It's not to say that there's no chance of him being able to develop that. But again, the Falcons don't necessarily have the history of doing that. As for your second question, I will get to this question next. Someone else asked this basic question. Lewis sent in an email. He says, what are your thoughts of trading back into the first half of the first round or very early second? Kevin Knight had a recent mock draft where he did this, and it's something I hope the Falcons do, especially since on one of your episodes, You mentioned the Falcons have two primary but not exclusive choices when picking in the first. Do they get the immediate fix for their pass rush or long-term solution at right tackle to neutralize edge rushers like Cam Jordan? I think trading up from our second pick into the late first accomplishes both of those needs, doesn't cost us the world like moving into the top 10 would, and allows us to still have seven picks to fill our depth. Thoughts? I think, Lewis, in general, you're right, but I think in the specifics of this particular draft, at least the way I see it, I don't really think trading back into the first round works, because I think the offensive tackles that you want to get are going to be gone, and the pass rushers that you want to get are going to be gone. I think, to me, I'm sort of projecting 10 to 12 defensive linemen and edge rushers being picked in the first round of this draft, 7 or 8 offensive linemen being picked in the first round of this draft. And I think for most of those guys, with maybe the exception of a one or two interior defensive linemen or one or two interior offensive linemen, I think pretty much all those guys can be gone by, say, like pick 23 or 24. I think this draft class, because of question marks at the quarterback position, because I don't necessarily see wide receivers going particularly high in this draft, like, I think we could get two tight ends drafted before we see a single wide receiver or cornerback taken in this draft, which is just crazy to me. So I think, really, what are you trading up for? What are you trading back in round one to get? Because I think unless you're going to try to jump from 45 to 20, which is going to be very prohibitive of cost, it's not going to cost you just like a third round pick. That's going to cost you probably a future first or a future second. I don't see how you're going to move up and get a guy that is the equivalent of a first round talent at those positions. I think, really, if you're moving back into round one from pick 45, your realistic, you know, jumping off point is maybe pick 32 with New England, or pick 30 or something like that with Green Bay. And so I think by that point in the first round, all the good offensive tackles, all the good pass rushers are going to be gone. And so you're just basically getting a better second round sort of talent at those positions. And so for me, like, that's part of the reason what fuels my sort of, you know, doom and gloom, I guess you could say, or fatalistic perspective of sort of the Falcons kind of have to make a tough choice, because I just think the way this draft is likely to set up, and I could be wrong about that, and, you know, I think Kevin Knight's mock that you're referring to, he had the Falcons taking Ed Oliver at 14 and then Cleveland Farrell at 27. I would be shocked if Cleveland Farrell makes it out of the top 20 picks. I've obviously said many times I don't think Ed Oliver's going to last to pick 14. I could see him dropping out of the top 10, but I don't see him dropping all the way to 14. And so I don't know how realistic that is. No shade at Kevin or anything like that. But so for me, at least, I just look at this draft and I'm just like, it's kind of a hard choice. And I at least from my perspective, but when you sort of look at it from a team building standpoint and you're looking at offensive line versus defensive line, I think if your choice is to take the first round offensive lineman and say settle for two, you know, mid-round defensive linemen versus taking the first-round offensive lineman and settling for two mid-round offensive linemen, which I think is kind of, again, the way this draft is probably going to set up, is the way that the Falcons would have to do it. I think the first choice, the first-round offensive lineman and the settling for the mid-round defensive lineman, makes a lot more sense from a team-building standpoint, simply due to the fact, for no other reason than basically a C-plus defensive lineman, or whatever the case may be, is what you expect to get with your mid-round picks, goes a lot further than a C-plus offensive lineman because of the nature of rotating defensive linemen. Offensive linemen have to play every snap. You're not going to, you know, like, you look at a player like Tyler Davidson, who's a good run defender but doesn't give you really anything as a pass rusher. But you can go out there and say, hey, Tyler Davidson, you can play some early downs for us. You can play some base defense for us and give us a lot of value as a run defender, and we can pull you off the field in nickel situations, and that's valuable. You can't do the equivalent of that on the offensive line. You can't have James Carpenter playing your rundowns and then having Brandon Fusco come in on passing downs. Maybe you could do that, but I don't think it's probably going to work out in your favor too well. So you need sort of more of an every down difference maker as an offensive lineman. That's part of the reason is, like, if you have a C-plus offensive lineman starting for you, you're going to want to replace that guy. If you have a C-plus defensive lineman, he's just part of your 8-man rotation. That's no big deal. Most teams have C-plus defensive linemen, you know, ideally on the back half of that rotation and not in the front half. But, you know, you're going to have C plus offensive defensive linemen that are going to contribute to your team. C plus offensive linemen are basically ideally are going to ride the bench and never play a single snap, right? You know, and if they do, you're going to be wanting to be like, let's not have that happen ever again. And that's arguably what the Falcons have had in the guard position for the last couple of years and at other spots on their offensive line in the last couple of years. And you see, you know, the Falcons try to upgrade those spots the following offseason. So I think that's part of the reason why I kind of side more towards the offensive line in terms of sort of being like, if you have to pick sort of one or the other to come away of this draft, I think you got to get the best talent at the offensive line than necessarily on the defensive line, just simply due to the fact that I can do a lot more with less on the defensive line than I can on the offensive line. So, you know, going back to your original question, I don't necessarily know who you're trading up for in that situation because I don't see any of the premium pass rushers, at least the guys that we're talking about, you know, being on the table as a potential mid-round pick for the Falcons in the first round, being available at the end of the first round. I think you're just basically going to be trading up for a guy that probably is a second round talent, which what's the point of giving away a third or fourth round pick to get a better second round talent? So, you know, the idea of trading back into the first round doesn't make a ton of sense to me. But we got more questions to answer on today's episode, and we'll get to those in just a moment. But before we do, I do want to remind you of the MLB and NBA sides of the Locked On Podcast Network, where you can find a daily podcast devoted to all 30 NBA teams and a growing number of MLB teams, including the Locked On Hawks podcast with host Brad Rowland and the Locked On Braves podcast with host Dylan Short. Find them on whatever podcast platform you prefer to get your Locked On podcast, including the new Himalaya podcast app. Download that at the App Store of your choice. Your team every day. Lewis asks, do you foresee the Falcons trading Beasley midseason to get something for him before he becomes a free agent and we get nothing for him? I think it's unlikely, but what are your thoughts? Yeah, I think it's unlikely that the Falcons will move Vic Beasley at the midpoint. It's possible, but I think unless they land a top-notch edge rusher in this year's draft, I would expect them to basically stick with Vic Beasley for the entirety of the 2019 season. Now, if they wind up drafting someone like a Brian Burns in round one or even a Cleveland Farrell or whoever, even a Rashawn Gary, I think it opens the door for that possibility. But without that, I don't necessarily see it as anything but a long shot because you're assuming that if he walks in free agency next year, he'll get signed by somebody else and the Falcons will land a third or fourth round compensatory pick in 2021 for Vic Beasley. So unless you're going to get a better offer in next year's draft, as a trade point, so, you know, unless basically someone's going to offer you a third or fourth round pick in 2020 for Vic Beasley, which I think is unlikely at this point, then I don't necessarily see you trading for him. And, you know, I just think you're probably going to, you know, unless you get a lot more out of somebody currently on this roster that I'm not expecting to get, I think you're still looking at Vic Beasley going to be your fourth or fifth best pass rusher this year, depending on sort of where you put Jack Crawford on that list. But I think unless someone else, you know, like a Stephen Means or somebody else emerges and becomes a guy that can give you 30 to 40 pressures or 6 to 8 sacks, which is sort of what the minimum expectation for Vic Beasley is going into this season, you're going to need that more than necessarily that third or fourth round pick that you're going to get, you know, somewhere down the road. You know, it's going to help you win more games immediately. And given the schedule, the Falcons are going to be more concerned about winning games in November than necessarily setting themselves up for, or one would hope, let's say, you know, who knows what's going to happen this season, but one would hope that we're invested in winning the maximum number of games in November and December to make the playoffs rather than sort of setting ourselves up to basically get the most possible picks in March and April and whatnot. So Greg Bruin asks, I haven't heard anyone else talking about it, but what are your thoughts about the negotiation to re-sign Julio Jones with 2 years left on your current deal? I absolutely love Julio and totally agree he's a top one or two receiver in all the league. I'm hearing $20 million per year numbers thrown around and no one is saying what should be said. We need a complete team and a top flight receiver over 30 years old is not a luxury we can afford. When his contract is up, it's maybe time to let him move on. You don't need a top five receiver to win a championship. Although Julio made the catch that should have won us a spring that we didn't because, again, we weren't a complete team. Look at all the Super Bowl winning teams in the last 5 years. You're the voice of reason, and I haven't heard any pushback from you regarding a new deal. Well, I think part of it, Greg, is I think this deal, as I've tried to explain a number of times, is it's basically just guaranteeing the next 3 years of Julio Jones. And instead of looking at it as a multi-$20 million a year, look at it as a three-year deal that's worth $50 to $55 million. And basically, the way that Julio Jones' current contract is, he's got like two more years and about $26 million in cap space, cap hits over the next 2 years. And so basically, he's currently on a two-year $13 million deal is basically one way to look at it. And this contract is probably going to be a three-year deal that gives him $17 or $18 million, and that's it. And it's going to guarantee that. It's going to make him happy. It's going to keep Julio Jones in Atlanta for the next 3 years, which are, I expect to be the last probably three, quote-unquote, peak seasons of his career before the Falcons are potentially looking to move on or at least transition to Calvin Ridley sort of being the go-to guy because, you know, three to four years from now, Calvin Ridley's going to be at the end of his rookie contract and do a big extension. And so that's going to be sort of the shift. But I think locking in Julio Jones for the next 3 years makes a ton of sense. It's part of the reason why you haven't heard that pushback from me because, you know, I said a number of times, Julio Jones is the sun. Everything in this offense revolves around him. And while it's not to sit here and say that the offense would completely fall apart if Julio Jones were to miss time or not be here, they'd still be a competent offense, but they would have to fundamentally change how they play football. Like, they can't do the, like I just don't think a guy like Mohamed Sanu is really going to work in a Julio Jones-less offense. In the same way that he works in a Julio Jones-centric offense. Because Julio is creating so many things for Mohamed Sanu that he's just not creating on his own. And that's not meant to be a shot at Mohamed Sanu. It's just the way it is. And so right now, I don't think the Falcons are really in a position to function without Julio Jones. And maybe over the next 2 to 3 years that you're talking about, they can shift towards that, you know, investing more in the offensive line, getting more quality, young, talented wide receivers that can do stuff on their own and create on their own, you know, solidifying the run game at the running back position, getting a sort of a new sort of feature back that, you know, unlike the current version of Devontae Freeman, can be a little bit more of a workhorse that can you can run your offense through. To a certain extent, and that may be what the Falcons transition to being more in sort of the 2022-2023 time frame when Julio Jones, I expect, won't be a Falcon anymore, but they're not that team right now. And so locking in Julio for the next 3 years gives you, you know, what Julio is right now, and it gives you the maximum amount of chances of competing at the highest levels, because we know right now, again, this team is not going to be a Super Bowl caliber team without Julio Jones doing Julio Jones's things in the immediate future. And it just buys you time that eventually you can maybe shift away from that type of offense as Calvin Ridley continues to develop and you can continue to acquire more talent at the various other positions on your roster. So that's why there's no real pushback for me, because to me, I think it maximizes your chances of success in the immediate future, and it just buys you, extends you some time so that you don't have to sort of suddenly morph into a completely different offense that basically the Falcons really haven't had to experience since, you know, before Matt Ryan was here. Because, you know, even when Julio wasn't here, you still had Roddy White basically being some version of that in their offense and being sort of the facilitator, and Tony Gonzalez as well. So, you know, we've never really had to see this offense operate without having, you know, a top five, top 10 type of talent at the wide receiver position. And hopefully we won't ever have to see that. Andrew Hathaway, you talked about taking an offensive lineman with the first pick, but do you think it's possible that they double down and take another offensive lineman in the second or third round? I think it'd be good for a guard to sit behind the two that we signed and hope we can outperform them as the season moves on. I think it makes sense, but again, I think it depends on who you're taking. I've said before that I think if they are going to double dip on the offensive line and go offensive tackle in the first round and then go offensive lineman later, it's more likely to be a guy that has center guard versatility so that that guy can come in immediately and be the backup to Alex Mack and maybe be the heir apparent to Alex Mack rather than a pure guard. I think that's more likely, but you know, I'm looking around at this draft class and I'm like, who's that guy going to be? I don't think it's going to be Eric McCoy because I think he's going to be gone by the time you get to pick 45. I like Elgton Jenkins, but I don't necessarily know if the Falcons are going to fall in love with Elgton Jenkins over, say, addressing, you know, their cornerback position or another position of need, a defensive line or whatever. Chris Lindstrom would be a really solid pick at 45, but I think he's going to be, again, he's probably going to be a late first rounder as well. So I feel like if you're going to double dip on the offensive line, it's probably more likely that you're going to have to wait till day three and just take a flyer on a Lamont Gilliard or somebody else like that that's more of a developmental guy than necessarily a guy that you can expect to come in immediately and start for you. But certainly if one of those guys, like I mentioned, McCoy, Jenkins, or Lindstrom, slides to pick 45, I think there's a good chance that Jenkins is going to be there. But if one of those guys is there, then I wouldn't necessarily at all fault the Falcons for pulling the trigger on that guy. Andrew Hathaway's next question is, do you believe if the Falcons trade up for Oliver, it has any impact on the future Grady deal, particularly if Oliver performs at a high level his rookie year? I don't think they really impact one another just because there's a hard deadline before the season starts with Grady Jarrett getting a long-term deal on July 15th. And so therefore, we're going to know sort of what Grady Jarrett's future in Atlanta is before Ed Oliver or whoever, plays a single snap for the Falcons. Basically, in my eyes, if Grady Jarrett doesn't have a long-term deal done by July 15th, it's not going to ever get done. I just don't see a scenario where he comes back after this season and the Falcons can come to an accord next February/March with Grady Jarrett when they couldn't do it this summer. Nor do I, and given that the fact that the Falcons are going to have Deion Jones and Austin Hooper and Devondre Campbell hitting the market, and Deion Jones, if they don't get a deal done before the season or during the season, he's going to probably with 98% certainty be the franchise tag player. So you're not going to really franchise tag Grady Jarrett for a second year in a row unless you can get a deal done with Deion Jones. And even if you do get a deal done with Deion Jones, I don't know if you want to franchise tag Grady Jarrett because next year his tag is going to go from $15 million to $18 million, over $18 million to do so, which is going to be very prohibitive on your caps, particularly if you're going to have to spend more to keep guys like Hooper and Campbell than you did this past offseason and other free agents as well. So I just kind of think regardless of whether the Falcons take a player like Ed Oliver or take another interior defensive lineman early in this draft that could, quote-unquote, be considered Grady Jarrett insurance, it's not really going to affect whether or not the Falcons are going to get a deal done with Grady Jarrett because basically if they don't get a whether that guy comes in and plays well doesn't really affect it because we'll know by July 16th whether Grady Jarrett's going to be a Falcon beyond 2019. Is basically what I'm saying. Now, if an Ed Oliver or whoever comes in and plays well as a rookie, does that soften the blow of Grady Jarrett probably eventually departing? Absolutely. But I don't think they're really affecting one another. Tracy Edwards at Vic Tracy Ed asks, how many players do you predict the Falcons will actually draft considering the theory that they cannot sign 9 picks? 7. Fan since 1988 asks, with a new offensive coordinator and the schedule starting off the way it does, would you expect the Falcons to play their starters on offense more this preseason? I think that does make a lot of sense. I think last year the Falcons kind of didn't play their main guys a lot because they were afraid of injuries. Obviously, that didn't necessarily work out in their favor. So even without the schedule being a factor into it, I'd be curious to sort of see if the pendulum sort of swings back and Dan Quinn's decides to work some of the key guys a little bit more than he did a summer ago. I wouldn't expect the Matt Ryans and the Devontaes and the Julios and Sanus and Max. I still expect those guys that have been proven, in this league to still be on a pretty reasonable pitch count. So, but I think we might see, some of the other starters and certainly some of the key backups probably playing a lot more in the preseason than they did a year ago, particularly on the offensive line, just because I think I'm hoping that we're going to actually have some real competitions there. Even though we expect Jamon Brown and James Carpenter and have the scale sort of weighted in their favor, I don't expect the Falcons to not give guys like Fusco and Schweitzer potential first team reps this summer, as well as the potential of a competition between Ty Sambrello and hopefully a early round pick as well. So we might see the offensive line get more reps, probably Mac being the one exception. He doesn't have anything to prove. So I think it does make sense for the starters to get more reps this preseason. I think, maybe that's just a natural factor of playing 5 preseason games. And so just having an extra game means the starters are going to play more. And so when you factor in, the 2 teams that the Falcons start the season off against, Minnesota and Philadelphia, 2 of the better defenses that the Falcons are going to face on their schedule, as I mentioned on yesterday's episode, breaking down the schedule, you do want to see this offense hit the ground running. So it does make sense that they'll probably get a little bit more work, at least in the penultimate preseason game, in that what would normally be the third preseason game, but for the Falcons would be the fourth preseason game. So instead of basically what I think the Falcons have done the last 2 years is pull those guys after maybe like a couple of series, we might actually see them go into the third quarter, which was something that was, I think, Mike Smith used to do on a regular basis, but I don't think we've really done with Dan Quinn outside of maybe one preseason over these last 4 years. So, yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Justin Sandu asks, which players on the current roster would play the in spots and the base downs at five technique? Steven Means, Chris Odom, and Jacob Tuodi Mariner are the three guys currently on the roster that probably, if the season started today, would be playing that five tech strong side defensive end spot. I think right now, in terms of who's going to play the Leo position in the base defense, which was formerly played by Brooks Reed, I don't think the Falcons have that guy currently on the roster, and I think they'll probably draft somebody to fill that role. But I guess if the season started tomorrow, you might see them put Steven Means there, or Chris Odom there, or possibly putting Tack McKinley there. I know other people have talked about it, and I've talked about it before. There's the possibility you could put Jack Crawford on as the strong side base defensive end, and then putting one of these other guys like Means or Odom at the Leo position. You could also put Jack Crawford at the Leo. That, you know, when he played defensive end in Dallas, his role was more akin to the Leo than it was necessarily the strong side base defensive end. So those. I hope that answers your question, Justin. Last question from DWizzy 1997. Considering that we have five divisional games in a row, is that a good thing or a bad thing? We have the opportunity to give five divisional opponents losses. Does that have a bigger impact, positive or negative, for our playoff chances as opposed to having division opponents throughout? I currently, Davon, have a difficult time seeing how it's a positive. You know, just because divisional games tend to be tougher, they tend to be closer, they tend to go down to the last, you know, one or two possessions. And so you have to play, you know, obviously you have to play four quarters in every game. But, you know, it's a lot harder to build 34 to 20 leads going into the fourth quarter in divisional games as it might be in say, other games, at least historically. They tend to be very close due to the familiarity that teams have with them, and a lot of these divisional games are one-score games. And I think having five of those games in a row is going to wear down your team, and particularly when you get that, you know, the Falcons have a short week with the Saints sandwiched between two other division games against the Panthers and Bucks. So it's one of those things where it seems like it's setting up to really sap the Falcons at the point in time in the season where you're hoping that they're trending up, and you have these five games that are really sort of situated to really sort of be this major hurdle, a major speed bump for their season as they're hopefully getting their stride going, going into that bye week. So I don't necessarily see it as a positive. Maybe it could be. Again, sitting here today, it seems far-fetched that it's a positive. I don't want to sit here and paint it as like, oh, there's no way that the Falcons can survive it, and doom and gloom and skies fall. That's not what I'm trying to sit here and say. It feels like it's an extra hurdle that like no other team is being asked to, you know, not to sit here and be like there's bias or anything like that, but it does feel like it's just more work that the Falcons are going to have to do. It's making their job a lot harder is basically what I'm trying to sit here and say. So we'll have to see how it works out. The one thing I will say about this schedule, which I think, you know, as I mentioned on yesterday's episode, it's a tough one. If the Falcons do manage to come out of this season winning 10 or more games based off of how this schedule is structured, they're going to be a very battle-tested team going into the playoffs. And I know I would want to play this Falcon team if they're able to win 10 games with this schedule, the way that it's structured and the way that it seems to go out of its way to sort of give them the maximum number of hurdles that they will have to face. So that's the positive you can say about it, what does not kill you makes you stronger, so to speak. So that's what I'll say in terms of positivity. But you just got to, you know, not to be too grim, but you just got to get stabbed 14 times. And if you survive that, hey, man, you're going to be a lot better for that. But, you know, good luck being stabbed 14 times. Oh, man. Okay. That's a weird way to end the show, but that's how I'm going to end it. So we'll be back Monday. I'm hoping to get a guest on this weekend to talk more draft and really get into the nitty gritty of some of these prospects. That's been something I've been trying to do, but coordinating schedules over this past week hasn't necessarily worked in my favor. So we're going to try to cram it all in for next week and get you sort of last minute takes setting up for the draft. But if you have any feedback, you know where to hit me up, Twitter, Facebook, email, Locked On Falcons for the social media, LockedOnFalcons@mail.com for the email. You can comment at FalcFans.com. Until then, guys.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.